we discuss the subject of emuna, which is pretty much all the time mistranslated in our English Bibles as faith or belief. And the reason we got on the subject of emuna last week is because in chapter 14 of Joshua, we read the part about how Caleb inherited the town of Hebron. And whenever you see the word Hebron, right away there are some things that should go through your mind. First one is Abraham. This is where Abraham pretty much made his home. This is the area where Abraham and Sarah were buried. This is the place where Isaac and his wife are buried, and Jacob and Leah are buried. And in fact, the sages, as a tradition, says that Adam and Eve are even buried there. And Abraham, being a man of emunah, a man who encountered God, was given some facts and insight by God, and then walked in loyalty to that truth and arrived at Hebron, and that's where he's buried today. That is important for us to study that subject of emunah, because if you look at the life of Caleb and the life of Abraham, you'll find many parallels. You'll find many parallels. Yet Caleb was a Gentile who was grafted into Israel and inherited the town of Hebron. It's an amazing story. Caleb's a picture of us. It should be a picture of, I should say, we should be a picture of Caleb and of a man of that kind of emunah. Let's review again a little bit about what emunah is, and we'll continue our discussion even a bit further. Truth consists of the first, middle, and last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. If we put the alphabet on a line like this, you'll see that the Aleph, the first letter of Emet, truth, is the first letter of the alphabet. The middle letter of Emet is right in the middle of the alphabet, and the last letter of the word truth, Emet, is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And the teaching here, the lesson is that truth covers all the Word of God. And if we want to know truth, we must always start at the beginning and not stop till we reach the end. Because if you don't start at the beginning, and if you don't reach the end, what you have is a bit of truth. You have a bit of truth. But emunah, which as I said is most often mistranslated as faith or belief, is made up of the first letter of the alphabet, and it's made up of the middle letter of the alphabet, just like emet. And then it ends with the very next letter, the nun. And it stops there. Emunah takes you by the hand and walks you only so far. But then the rest is darkness and pain. And what emunah truly is loyalty or faithfulness to what we know to be true. Bill summed it up so well in his sharing this morning from the Torah portion. The very first commandment is not an order. It's a statement of fact. Anoki Adonai Elohecha. I am the Lord your God. That's it. It's a statement of fact. It's a statement of truth. And if you embrace that and you hold on to that and you wrap your life around that and you're loyal to that truth, you will live out your loyalty by obeying then the following nine commandments. And God's word, you'll seek out what pleases this Lord and who you claim to be your God. And you want to do what's pleasing to him. And even sometimes it doesn't look like the Lord's on his throne, but it looks like the Lord took a leave of absence. When it looks like everything is chaos and everything's dark, and you start wondering, is Lord really the Lord my God? Is he really God? And you say, yes, I'm going to be loyal to what I know is true, then that is emunah, and it will bring you to the goal. An interesting thing about the word emunah. These last two letters of emunah spell the word manna. Manna. Now what is manna? It means, what is it? In other words, it starts here, it walks you along, then it stops, and then you ask, what is it? What's next? Where do I go? And just like with manna, you went to bed at night with nothing to eat, and you went through the darkness without food, but you were loyal to the fact that God says in the morning there's going to be food. And you went through the dark knowing that in the morning there'd be something to eat. And in the morning you went out and there was manna. And that was something God taught on a daily basis. This walk of Emunah, something you need to understand about it. There are some actions of Emunah which take place in a short period of time, maybe a period of hours. A testing can come, it can start and finish within a 24-hour period. And we see that with Israel every day, with the manna. There's a test of faith. Would you store up the manna to take you through the day, and in the night realize in the morning there would be more? Or would you be loyal to the truth that God spoke? There are other tests that might take place every week. In other words, do you have enough faith in God that the work you did in 6 days is enough to carry over through the seventh? Or do you believe, no, I need to work that seventh day or I can't make ends meet, I can't make my finances come around, I will not be successful in this area or that area, I've got to work that seventh day. Now, if a life is involved, if it saves a life, then you need to work on the Sabbath. But if it doesn't save a life, then if you truly love the Lord, you're going to want to try to please Him. And you're going to trust that in those 6 days, I will have done enough, and on the seventh day, I can rest and enjoy the fruits of what we've done in those 6. There's a weekly test of Emunah. You know, sometimes I fall flat on my face. Don't let me sit here and you think, oh, Grant's the epitome of how to keep the Shabbat. I'm not. I'm learning. I'm just a kindergartner when it comes to Shabbat. I'm learning so much. It's a new thing to me. But it's a wonderful thing that I'm learning to do. There's some things that will take place over a period of months, or years, or generations even. You know, I'm reminded of that passage in Hebrews. In fact, let's go there now. I want to look at a few passages from the New Testament scriptures. And instead of using the word faith, let's use the word that the writer had in mind, which is Emunah. Let's start with Hebrews, and let's look at chapter 11, the Hall of Emunah. Not the Hall of Faith, the Hall of Emunah. And let's look at the definition that the writer gives us. And I think this definition, which I never could quite wrap my brain around before, now makes perfect sense. Now, Emunah, verse 1, now Emunah is the assurance of things hoped for. Would that be future or past? That's future. It's the substance of things hoped for, and it's the evidence. Now, right there, that word evidence is referring to past events, the evidence of things not seen. In other words, Emunah is something that gives me substance of what I'm looking for at the end. It talks about Abraham in Genesis, and he's also listed here in this chapter. God appeared to him. God spoke to him in no uncertain terms. He knew that he knew that he knew that God spoke to him and said, leave everything familiar. And go and follow me, and I'm going to show you a land. I'm going to take you to a land. But you can't see it now. He couldn't see the place he was going to. But he had the substance of what he hoped for and the fact that God had spoken to him, and God does not lie. So as he's walking to this land he's never seen, he's walking in pure Emunah, he had evidence of what could not be seen. That's looking to the past, by the way. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. Evidence is something that's proof of what has occurred. So substance of things hoped for is looking forward. Evidence of things not seen are the things I did see, but I can't see now, but I hold on to them because I'm loyal and faithful to what God has shown me. You understand what Emunah is here now in this verse? Go on down a bit further. And towards the end of the chapter, it tells us that, let's go down to verse 13. It says, all these died in Emunah without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance. In other words, they were still walking toward the goal. They never reached it. Their lives ended because this was a long Emunah. This is a talk about a kingdom to come. I pray we all live until the day that kingdom comes. That'd be wonderful to be alive in the flesh when that kingdom comes. But we may not see it come in our lifetime here. But I know it's coming. I know it's coming because I have God's promise that it's coming, and I must live in preparation for that kingdom. If I know one way or the other, either dead or alive, I'm going to face God and give an accounting for my life. I know that's going to happen. If I truly know that, even when it looks like that doesn't really happen. There may not, it may seem like there is no God. I must live my life with the knowledge that I will meet him and give an accounting of my life. Let's look at a few other passages. Let's go back to Romans 14:23. Romans 14:23, which is actually a quote, I believe, isn't it? No, I'm thinking of something else. Romans 14:23, but he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he's eating and not from faith, and whatsoever is not from emuna is sin. If you're not living out of loyalty to God's truth, then you're what you're doing is falling far short of the mark. 1 Corinthians 2:5. I quoted Rabbi Katz a number of times last week, and this verse reminds me of some of his statements. It says here that your emunah should not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. You know, I think there's a fallacy that much of Christianity and Judaism and many religions falls into, and that's trying to prove God's existence. And if we can just prove God's existence, then people will accept him and live for him. Katz says if they were somehow convinced of God's existence scientifically and accepted him on that basis, he says that's a pitiful kind of faith. Because it's a faith that rests from the neck up. It rests in some kind of scientific measurable phenomena. Well, what happens if some new phenomena comes along that disproves the old phenomena? Does your faith just collapse? He says it's a wretched, pitiful, pathetic kind of emunah. You see, emunah is a spiritual thing. It dwells in a different part of the mind from knowledge. Knowledge dwells in the neck up, but emunah dwells in a much, much, much deeper place. There are different tools. There's different equipment and principles that proves emunah. Emunah is spiritual, and we must use spiritual tools to achieve it. You see, in every single person, there is an awareness that God exists. There's an awareness that there is sin, that there is a standard of righteousness, and there's a judgment to come. Every single person has those tools, has that seed of truth within them. And that's enough to exercise emunah. You know what you can do to build emunah? Pat suggests that you write down your life. You make a Megillah of your life. A Megillah is a scroll. And there are 5 books in the Bible that are called Megillot. And Esther is one of those. And I mentioned last week that Esther means hidden. I shall hide myself. Because throughout the book of Esther, you don't find God's name ever mentioned. Only book of the Bible where God's name is never mentioned. And it would almost seem to be non-existent. And everything in Esther seems to go totally wrong. Seems like the bad guy's winning. Old Haman's, he's getting away with his plot. And yet little coincidences occur. Mordecai happens to overhear things about Haman. One night, Ahasuerus can't sleep, so he brings the records in. A coincidence, right? And they read about how Mordecai happened to baffle this attack and this plot. And this little thing happens, and that little thing happens, but when you get to the end of the book, it has a happy ending. All of a sudden, you see all the chaos and all the things that could never work out, all of a sudden working out, and Mordecai and Esther are elevated. And we see Haman and his evil sons hung on the gallows. And see, if you take your life, and you begin to write it out, and you write about all the chaos, about this and that and this and that happened and this happened, I met this person, this thing occurred in my life, and this tragedy occurred, and you bring it up to where you are right now, you're going to see that there is order all the way through up to this very point. And your life. I don't know why I do this. But I look at my life and I realize there are no coincidences. And what looked like pain and tragedy and chaos at the time was God behind the scenes. An amazing thing about the book of Esther, I said his name is not found in the book, God's name. Actually, it's found four times, but it's hidden. Because Esther means I shall hide myself, and God hides his presence throughout that book. But it's found four times. There are four places. One place, you find four consecutive words. If you take the first letter of each of those words, it spells out Adonai. Another place, you find four words. If you take the first letter of those four words backwards, it spells Adonai. A third place, you find four words. If you take the last letter of each of those words, it spells Adonai. And then the fourth place, you find four words in a row. If you take the last letter of each of those words and spell them backwards, it spells Adonai. So you find his name four times. Twice at the beginning letters of words, forwards and backwards, and twice at the end letters of four consecutive words, forwards and backwards. So it's not happenstance. There's order there. But it's hidden order. It's behind the scenes. And Amuna is faithfulness to what you know is true, even when it's darkness and pain, and that's your experience right now. You're faithful to what you know is true. That's Emunah. Now, Jim.
You're explaining how that was hidden. You went very close to it in your mind. When you come across the word faith, and Emunah may not be in synonymous with the exact meaning of it, how do you know that you're looking at
generally, you're safest just put the word Amunah in. The question is, how do you know if the word there is really faith or belief or truly Amunah? You know, the Hebrew writers, Amunah was what their experience was. That's what they wrote and talked about. And you're pretty much safe to use the word Amunah just about everywhere. Now, if it obviously does not fit, then the word there is trust, okay? Trust or belief. But generally, Amunah is the word you're going to be looking at. Let's look at a few more passages where we'll see examples of this. Galatians 2:16. Nevertheless, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the Torah, but through Emunah in Messiah, Yeshua. Even we have believed in Messiah Yeshua that we may be justified by Emunah in Messiah, and not by works of the Torah. In other words, what is Emunah? Loyalty to truth. That's loyalty in action. It's not dead works, obedience to some letter of the law. But it's obeying the Torah out of a knowledge that God is God, out of love for God. And even when things look dark, even when I don't seem to be getting the blessings from my obedience that they promised me, if you just do this, you'll get blessed. I don't seem to be getting blessings, but you do it anyway because it pleases God because you know it's true. And how does it say we're justified? We're justified by Emunah. Isn't that an amazing thing? Amazing thing? We used to think we're justified just by believing. If I just believe, I get the right mental attitude, I'll be justified. And you chase your tail. Well, do I believe enough? Amunah is something, are you being loyal to the truth? Is it living out through your actions? It's interesting that the 613 commandments of the Torah, almost all of them, almost all, have to do with physical actions. They almost all have to do with physical actions. But those physical actions are not based on a loyalty to our God. And instead you're just doing them to try to get reward. See, doing just for reward, that's legalism. But doing them out of loyalty to God, that's Emunah. They may look the same, but the source of your strength is completely different. You understand? This is just a couple more. Let's stay in Galatians. Go to chapter 3, verses 7 and 8. Very, very familiar passage. Therefore, be sure that it is those who are of Emunah who are sons of Abraham. Don't you love that? You could almost call him the father of Emunah. I mean, you look in him and you see a man who God spoke to him, then God removed the evidence of his presence, and then Abraham walked faithfully in the light and loyalty to what he knew. Therefore, be sure that it is those who are of Emunah who are sons of Abraham. And the scriptures, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by Emunah, preach the gospel beforehand to Abraham. Isn't that amazing? Abraham was a Gentile. He was justified by emunah, loyalty to truth. We're justified the same way. Colossians 2:7. Having been firmly rooted and now being built up in Him and established in your emunah, just as you were instructed and overflowing with gratitude. How about Galatians 2:20? We skip that verse. I am crucified with Messiah. Nevertheless, I live. Yet this life which I now live, I live by what? Emunah. I live by emunah. In other words, I don't see Messiah now. He ascended to heaven. I don't see Him, but I know what occurred is true. I know His words are true, and I will walk in loyalty to what I know occurred and what is truth. I'm willing to die for that, and Paul did die for that. You see what emunah is? It's loyalty to the truth. I had to go back and review that just a bit because our discussion today continues with emunah as we look at the life of Caleb. Let's go to chapter 15 of Joshua now. Now most people, they get up to about chapter 15 and they skip the judges. And they think, well, what is the deal of all these borders and all these cities? There are hundreds of them. Just names of cities that have no meaning for us. And you know, and honestly, I didn't have time to look up every city and see what its name meant, try to figure out the lesson, but I know there are lessons there. It's just a matter of taking the time to do it. But one thing I did notice, there are six Hebrew words that are used to describe the borders and of Israel and of the various tribes. And it just struck me, if nothing else, it should strike you how detailed God is that Israel know exactly where its borders are. And in Israel, that each tribe knows exactly where its borders are. God spends chapters describing the details. This is where the border is. This is the line. On this side of the line, this is yours. On that side of the line, it's not yours. How detailed and how specific. And it's like, Lord, what are you trying to teach me? And I think this is what He's trying to teach us. He's saying the limitations of your life, of what's permitted and what's forbidden, are according to My word. You know, when you're walking through the wilderness, you wouldn't just be walking through Israel. You're not going to walk through Israel all of a sudden see a line in the sand. On this side of the line, it says Judah. And on that side of the line, it says Egypt. It's not written there. It's not a physical line. And see, in your lives, there's not a physical line that's obvious to us. The limitations of what's permitted to us and what's forbidden to us are not obvious at all to us. We are sheep. We tend to wander outside the area we should be in because we don't see the borders. But they're there. They are there, and God sees them clearly, and He reveals them to us through His Word. And these borders would add structure and peace and security and safety and fulfillment to our lives as believers. We need to know where the lines are. And God gives us lines in every area of our life through Torah. Now, I used to look at these lines as restrictions, and I was so happy I was free. I was so free as a Christian, I was miserable. I was so free, I was constantly getting myself into jeopardy and having to apologize for stupid things I did because I was exercising my freedom. Something was really wrong with this picture. And the cry in my heart was, how am I supposed to live this Christian life? And I would look at this denomination and that denomination. They're all kind of doing their own thing and all claiming that it's right, but they didn't seem any happier than I was. Making their own borders. And you see, God gives us the borders of Israel because Israel is like you and you and you and each of us. It's like me. Israel is like a person. And God says, within these borders, this is you. Do not go out of these borders. And within you, there are borders. You know, when a surgeon goes to do heart surgery, He doesn't have to do an x-ray to figure out where the heart is. It's not like he operates on one guy and the heart's behind his right ear, and another guy, it's in his knee. He knows he makes an incision here on the chest, the heart's going to be there. And if he makes an incision here, that's where the kidney is. And over here is the other kidney, and here's the stomach, there's the spleen, the gallbladder, because we're mapped out. God has ordered us physically and mapped us out. And if your map is not right, then that means there's a deformation there. There's something abnormal about you. But normal people have their hearts in one place, and their livers in another place, and their stomachs, and everything's in the right place. In the spiritual realm, the same is true. And God gives us borders. He says, here are the 6 days you do your work. Now there's a line. There's 24 hours from sundown Friday, sundown Saturday. You guard that. You keep it holy. You rest. Spend that with me. He says, here are foods that are permitted. Here are meats that are forbidden. But any edible green plant, that's yours for food. There's the line for your diet. He says, here's a line for your finances. You give this portion to me. The rest of that is yours. How about your desires? We have many things to desire. God gives us a line. He says, you can desire what you want, but don't desire what's evil, and don't covet what belongs to your neighbor. Sex. God says, I gave you that sexual desire. Now here where the lines are. It's within marriage with one other person, within the confines of marriage. I don't like the word confines, within the borders of marriage. I don't find marriage confining at all. But inside that, that's where you can enjoy sex. Outside of that, you cross the line. Wine. Wine is something God's given us to enjoy. But there's a line, drunkenness. You don't cross that line. You get the idea? And you can take any area. I'm just take any area. The Torah addresses it and gives us borders and says, these are where the borders are. Stay within the borders. And you're protected, you're secure, and everything's where it should be. You follow what I'm saying? It's so specific with these physical borders, the word's just as specific with the spiritual ones. And we would do well to pay heed to that. Because you cross the borders, you're outside God's protection then. Okay? You're outside the land of promise. You're outside the land of shalom. And we need to know those borders. They are not obvious. That's the thing I must stress. They are not obvious. There's a way that seems right to a man, but the ends of there are what? Death. Separation. You've wandered so far away from where you're supposed to be, you're separated from God. The borders are not obvious. We must know the word. This is the blueprint for our lives. This is the blueprint. We need to know where the rooms are, where the walls are. And there's security and peace then. There are 6 words that are used throughout here to describe these borders. And you may not have really paid attention to them, but I don't have overheads for this, so I'll just give them to you. Many times they'll describe a border, it'll say, Vayorad, it descended. So in other words, it descends from this point to this point. Another one is Va'olo, it ascended. In fact, on the east of Jerusalem, whenever you're going from east to west, the word is ascend. And when you're going west from Jerusalem, it's always descend. Sometimes the borders in our lives are some places where we go up, there are places we go down, but they're ordained of God. Another one is Vayotso, which means it goes out. It'll say, and the border goes from this point and it goes out, Vayotso, to this point. There are other places where it says Va'ovor. Va'ovor means it crosses. In other words, the border crosses a certain point. Another word is Vanosav, which means it circles around. Okay, the border goes this, goes east, but then it, in the Ovor, it circles around. And, Vanosav, it circles around this point. And another one is Vato'ar, which means it proceeds in a straight line from point A to point B. Well, when you read this, pay attention to those 6 things. It's interesting, there are 6 adjectives that describe the border. I guess they're actually verbs. It goes from here to here. I'm not sure. I don't know grammar that well. But there are 6 of them. And in the Jewish mindset, there are 6 physical dimensions. Up, down, left, right, forward, backward. And Hebrew mindset, there's not 3 physical dimensions, there are actually 6. Up and down, left and right, forward and backward. And there are 6 descriptors given to us of our border. And God tells me through this, He's interested about every area of our lives, above, below, left, right, in front, and behind. And he gives us information about all those things. My eyes only see forward. And I have to move all over the place to see other directions, but God sees all around me. He's behind me, and in front of me, above me, below me, to the left of me, to the right of me. He knows this area. He knows my life so well. He's my maker. And he knows where the borders are. But pay attention to those words and ponder on those some as you read through this chapter. Let's get to something that I think is pretty amazing. And I hope I can do a good job of describing what I think God is saying here. Go to chapter 15 of Joshua now, and verse 13. It says, to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, he gave a portion among the children of Judah in accordance with the Lord's word to Joshua. Kiriat Arba. Kiriat Arba means the city of four, F-O-U-R, the city of four. The father of the Anakim, which is Hebron. Hebron means joined. Let's stop a moment and discuss the Anakim. You know, the Bible, the Old Testament and New Testament both talk about some of the giants. So it uses different names. He uses Anakim, Nephilim, Rephaim, and there's one other one that we'll get to, the Giborim. And I've often been very curious about these, but reading through the Zohar just this last couple of weeks, I came to a really interesting passage that talks about these giants. Now, I have to say something about the Zohar. I have to get a few qualifiers here. First of all, I do not recommend it as something you should read, because there are too many more important things for you to read. And what I do is I steal a moment away here and there and read a few pages. Also, I don't recommend it's something you should read because it's tremendously confusing. I read, for every 10 pages I read, I'll find one paragraph I can understand, because it's all written in code. It's all written in code. It describes spiritual things, and since spiritual things are spiritual and not physical, we lack spiritual language to describe spiritual things. We're physical creatures. Our experiences are in the physical realm. Yet the Zohar is trying to describe spiritual things, so the only way to do it is allegorically, to take something physical that reflects the spiritual and talk about that physical thing. And as you read Zohar or anything in the Kabbalah, you must realize as you read about these physical things, it's not the physical things that are important or even in view. Everything's an allegory of something spiritual. And so it spiritualizes everything it discusses. And some of it's very murky and very, very, very difficult to understand. It's not impossible to understand. It's a very ancient book. It's been around for, the knowledge here has been around for thousands and thousands of years. But, nevertheless, it's a work the New Testament writers quote from extensively. So I'm not recommending it because I don't even understand it myself, but there are bits of it that just jump out, and all of a sudden you can grasp hold and say, I see what they're saying. And one of the things it talks about are these groups. There's a passage there where it talks about the mixed multitude, right? In your Bibles, it talks about the mixed multitude came out of Egypt. Well, right away the Zohar takes that phrase, mixed multitude, and allegorizes it, and says that there are forces that want to mix with the redeemed community, with Israel. There are forces that want to mix with us. What are these forces? And then it goes through and it lists the Amalekim, the Nephilim, the Giborim, the Rephaim, and the Anakim. And let's go through these and see what the Zohar says. Now, these are giants and groups that are mentioned in, especially in Torah and referred to in the New Testament. But the Zohar allegorizes them, takes what the word says, and says that here's the spiritual insight we can gain from that. Are you kind of with me so far? Have I totally lost you?
Are they pollutants?
Yes, exactly. It's the way to put it, pollutants. And I can't find a clean overhead. My overheads are all polluted. Let me see if I can find a clean one here. Okay, here we go. Let's take a look at some of these. First of all, let's talk about the Nephilim. N-E-F-I-L-I-M. Nephilim. Nephilim means the fallen ones. When you read in Genesis chapter 6, verse 2, it talks about the sons of God saw the children of men, and they came down, had sexual intercourse with these women, and these are the Nephilim, the fallen ones. These are the ones Jude, in Jude verse 6, Jude's only one chapter, Jude verse 6 talks about these angels as being bound in chains, which is a direct quote from Zohar. Where did Jude get that information? It's not found anywhere in the Bible that I could find where it talks about angels bound in chains. It's only referred to there in Jude. Until you come to Zohar, it talks about the Nephilim bound in chains in the abyss. Now, as the Zohar talks about the Nephilim, it says that what the Nephilim are is a spirit of lust. A spirit of lust. And it's interesting that it says that as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in the last days. And one of the reasons for the flood is because of the Nephilim and their activities on earth. And I believe, and I know for a fact, that there's such a spirit of lust let loose at this age, that lust and perversion is not the exception anymore. It is the norm. And it's not just the norm anymore among adults, but among young people and even children. And it's so easy for us to become callous to this. The sages say that human history looks like a body. Early in history was the head, when people thought and pondered. But the end of history is like the feet, the soles of the feet. And the sages do proclaim there are 6,000 years of human history that will pass before the Messiah comes. And on the Jewish calendar, we're just about at the 6,000th year. This is, what year is this? 5,700, 800 something, but I can never remember. The people think I'm smart. I can never remember the day. But we're very near the end of human history. And they say that this present age is like the soles of the feet because the sages say the soles of the feet are dead even while they're alive. The soles of your feet are all callous. That's why you can take a knife and you can cut at the soles of your feet. And cut away flesh, but it's dead flesh. I'll never forget in Israel, going along, I saw a vagrant sleeping on a bench. He had no shoes. And his feet must have been at least 3 inches thick because there's at least an inch of callus there. The callus on the bottoms of the soles of his feet was thicker than the soles of my shoes. I just stared. I'm glad he was asleep because I just kept staring at these feet. I had never before seen someone who'd spent their whole life barefoot, especially in a hot, rugged, or stony area like Israel, and his feet had at least a solid inch of callus on the bottom. And that's what this generation is like. It's dead while it's alive. It's on the earth. You know, the serpent's curse is that he would go upon his belly and feed upon the dust of the earth. And I see people today living like the serpent. They live according to their bellies, their appetites, and they feed upon the dust. What is dust? Dust of skin. You came from dust, you go to dust. It's death. They feed upon things that are dead, and they live according to their appetites, and they're dead while they're alive. That's what I see in the modern world. You know, as I read history, you begin to really see this present generation in light of past generations. We have really fallen. Nephilim means the fallen ones, and that's what we see. And this is a very, very dark time which we live. I don't need to tell you this.
That's a great way of trying to rewrite history.
Oh, of course. Revisionism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, any books on American history, they go back and they go to George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, make them all look like they're modern-day heels. And they weren't. Even most of the worst men, when I read books about criminals and murderers 200 years ago, you find these men, they were caught, they break down in tears, sorrowful for what they did. Not anymore. They're sorry they didn't kill more. It's a total different mindset these days. So there's this spirit which tries to mix with the redeemed community. The next one is the Giborim. This is the Hebrew word, that's used in Genesis 6:4. These are the offspring of the Nephilim. Let me read you what the Zohar says about these Geborim. Geborim comes from the Hebrew word Gibor, which means great or mighty. There's a children's book out, a wonderful allegorical book. It's called The Tower of Gebura. Maybe some of you have read it or your children have read it. And Gebura is from the Hebrew word Gibor, which means strong, powerful. The Geborim means the mighty ones and refers to the offspring of the Nephilim, who are the mighty ones. In fact, we believe that the Geborim are the ones who the ancient mythologies are based on, Jupiter and Saturn and all those individuals. They may have actually had some foundation in actual historical fact. Here's what the Zohar says of the spiritual Geborim. It says they build synagogues and yeshivas, putting the scroll of the Torah and the crown upon its top. But they do it for their own sake and for the love of themselves, not for the sake and love of the Creator. In other words, the Geborim, they say, is the spiritual attitude of religion, pride, and legalism. Isn't that interesting? They say that's what the spiritual element of the Geborim is. And in 1 Timothy 6:5, Paul warns Timothy about those who think godliness is great gain. In other words, they try to make financial gain off of a show of godliness. Do we see that today or what? You know, whenever you see evangelists on television, they're not all bad. But if they have a number at the bottom of the screen you can call in to make your pledge, they're bad. That's basically it. And sometimes they'll press up that number, call in for prayer. Yeah, you're going to call and they're going to pray that you'll give them money. That's what it comes down to. Not all of them, but I don't think you need too much discernment to know which are which. This spirit is alive and well today. And then there are the Rephaim. The Rephaim, these mean the shades or the shadows. That's what the word means, the Rephaim. And this is also found in Genesis chapter 6. And it says of the refined that they abandon the truth out of fear. And the Zohar says, quote, if they notice a time of distress coming upon Israel, they abandon them. Even if they have the power to save them, they do not want to do so. They abandon the Torah and avoid those who study it. Instead, they do favor to those who worship idols. And the Rephaim have children called the Anakim, and these are the ones who Caleb fought in Joshua chapter 5. The Anakim basically means giants. It comes from a word that means neck, of the long neck. So it could also refer to a necklace, a neck chain, but these are generally translated as the giants. And these are the offspring of the Rephaim. And you read about them in Deuteronomy 2:11. You can put the verse down. And these are actual physical giants who Caleb had to fight. Now, I put these two together because Deuteronomy 2:11 puts them together. The Anakim are the children of Rephaim. The Rephaim are shades, the cowards. They're practically not even there. Whereas the Anakim, we're really there. And as you look at these two, what the Zohar has to say, the best way I can put together is this. The Rephaim are the mountains. And the Anakim are the molehills. And they come in pairs. You know, there are molehills in your life that may look like giants. But Caleb, he'd gone to the promised land 40 years early. He'd seen the Anakim. He'd come back and says, we can take them. It's no big deal. And everybody else panicked. And sure enough, 40 years later, he goes in and kills the very four giants he'd seen 40 years earlier. And he did it single-handedly, it seems. He went four swats of the sword and they're gone. They're dead. Wipe them out. These four things, these four molehills that seem so gigantic, but see, what makes them look giant are the shades. You know what this is? You know what this is to me? The molehills in our lives, we make so huge in our minds. And these are the thoughts, the refinement of the thoughts we have. And in our minds, they become mountains and really they're molehills. You know, my biggest enemy is not the enemies I have. It's the enemies I make out of my enemies in my mind. My perceptions I can't trust. We have a way of minimalizing things that are serious and then expanding and making huge things that are small and minimal. We have a way of doing that in our lives. And these two, remember, the Anakim are the sons of the refined. And the refined means shades, whereas the Anakim were giants, but giants that were easily killed. It was all bluff. And in your lives, there are real things you must kill, but don't make them bigger than they are. Don't make them bigger than they are, because your worries and your fears and your thoughts are just shades. And what does the Zohar say about the refined? They just run away. They're all cowards. It's interesting. Goliath is a giant. Which one of these groups did he come from? According, it doesn't say specifically, but you can go back through and look where the Philistine giants came from. As you trace them back, they came from the Rephaim. And how was Goliath killed? Beating him to death? One pebble, and where? Right in the head. You see, these represent the thoughts. It takes one pebble, pop, and it's dead. One pebble of truth slays the false thoughts that we put into our minds. One giant, huge thought you've got, this huge worry, can be slain by a properly placed pebble of truth. That's all it takes. As you may have heard this before. Do you remember how many pebbles David took in his pouch? Five. Okay? How many did he need? One. And the sages have said the five pebbles represent the five books of Torah, but he only needed one. And then when you come over to Yeshua, and he's tempted by Satan, Yeshua had the five books of Torah available to him. But which one did he quote from all three times to slay Satan? I shouldn't say slaying, but to denounce him. Deuteronomy is the only one he used. Now, if he has five stones, he only needed Deuteronomy, and Satan left him alone. He quoted Deuteronomy three times each time he was tempted by Satan. Kind of interesting that David and the son of David had five stones in their pouch, but only needed one. And so, you understand what I'm not doing a good job of getting across. Do you kind of get the picture? Am I? Okay. All right, good. I'll take that. And then there's a fifth one. Now, the fifth one aren't giants at all. These are the Amalekites. The Amalekites. These are people. And we read about them in Exodus chapter 17. So let's go to Exodus 17. Now, yes, go ahead. That's certainly possible. Certainly possible. That's a good thought. Yeah, quit for any of them, yes. Yeah.
You just said the Amalekites were people. Now, does this mean that the other four groups were supernatural beings?
Well, they weren't giant. What I'm saying is they weren't giant. They're just normal-sized people, and lots of them. They were a nation of people that attacked Israel when they came out of Egypt.
But are these four groups...
These four are all giant people.
Or, I mean, I know they said in the feeling where, like, the angels that came down...
Yes.
What kind of offspring did they have? Were they human? Were they half human, half angelic?
Well, the Nephilim were angelic beings which fell. Okay? They fell because they lusted after human women. Their offspring were called the Giborim, the mighty men, the mighty ones of old.
It's not a human race.
Yes, it's a mixture. It's a polluted, yes. By the way, interesting thing about the Nephilim, the Zohar says... Now, let me back up a second. In Corinthians, Paul writes to the Corinthians, he says, don't you realize that we shall judge angels? Right? Do you remember that passage?
Right.
Where did Paul get that? Where do you find that in Scripture? Where do you ever get that idea that humans will judge angels? We're made a little lower than angels. Where do you get the idea that we will judge angels someday? Direct quote. Direct quote from the Zohar. Because what the Zohar says about the Nephilim is this. It says that God created man in order to rule over the angels. And then the Nephilim came along and said, Master, why do you make these creatures to rule over us? Why? And God answered and said, because if you were on earth where they are, you would sin worse than they do. And at that point, then the Nephilim looked down and saw the daughters of men and lusted after them and fell and sinned worse than man did. And that's in the Nephilim. Isn't that interesting? Now, did that actually happen? I don't know. But the concept, the truth behind the concept is the important thing. Always in Jewish thinking, it's not the physical that's important. It's the truth that lies behind the physical. It's not the parable itself that's important. It's the truth that the parable illustrates. That's the important thing. The eternal spiritual reality behind the parable. You know, I get a little put out with people who look at the parables of Yeshua and think, now, I wonder if that really happened. If that person really existed. If this Lazarus who went to the bosom of Abraham and this rich man who went to Hades, I wonder if that was really a real event. I don't care if it's a real event. It's the truth that's eternal and important for us. You get the picture? So, yes.
Acronym, how the simple words for a guy always picture resurrection Egypt.
Yes.
Like a witch.
Yes, so these five, the Zohar talks of these five as being like polluting spirits who want to attach to the redeemed community to pollute and destroy. I'll read their summation here in a moment. Amalek, chapter 17. Those of you who are with us in our study of the Torah last year, remember I really, really preached on Amalek. But we'll just try to do a real quick version of this. Chapter 17 of Exodus, verse 8. See verse 8? Back up and look at the few words that precede verse 8. Is the Lord among us or not? I think so many times we get attacked by Amalek when we start questioning, is the Lord really among us? But anyways, Amalek came and battled Israel. It's just like they came out of the blue. Kaboom, they just came. And Rephidim, Moses said to Joshua, choose people. They went out and battled, and it talks about how Moses is on the mountain. As he held up the staff, it says his hands were emunah. They were faithful to hold up the staff. And when he held them up, Joshua, in verse 13, it says, Joshua weakened Amalek. Notice it doesn't say he defeated him or destroyed him, wiped him off the face of the earth, weakened him and its people with a sword's blade. The sword's always a picture of what? The Word of God. The Lord said to Moses, write this as a remembrance in the book and recite it in the ears of Joshua. Now look what it says here, that I shall surely erase the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. That's God's promise, right? Has he fulfilled it yet? No. Because look at the next verse. Moses built an altar, called his name, the Lord is my miracle, or Adonai Nisi, and he said, for the hand is on the throne of God. The Lord maintains a war against Amalek from generation to generation. Now, look at those two sentences. He says, I will wipe their memory off of the earth, yet the Lord maintains a war against Amalek from generation to generation. Could he wipe them off the earth right now if he wanted? Yes. But he's chosen to stretch out this battle. Amalek means people of licking up. People of licking up the dust. Talk about lowlife. People of licking up. And you know what the Amalekites are a picture of? The flesh. Always with us. Battles always going on. But there's a day coming when it'll be defeated. But it's not here yet. You see, my flesh is the part of me that's not redeemed yet. It will be, but it's not yet. I'm still awaiting the redemption of the flesh, like Romans 8 talks about. And this flesh has its own appetites, its own will, its own desires. Yet there's a war going on in me because my spirit has other appetites, another will, and other desires. And my soul makes the decision. I can follow the nephesh, or you can call it the nephlesh. That might be a good way to remember that. Or I can follow the neshama, the spiritual. But there's a war going on. God promises me the war will come to an end someday and he'll win. But in the meantime, he maintains this war against Amalek from generation to generation to generation to generation. And that's the war that's going on in every one of us. Yes?
In Malachites, they said in the Jewish tradition that Haman's the descendant of Amalek.
Yes, correct.
And also, most of the stuff on the angels and fallen race is mentioned in the Book of Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
And Jude quotes from the Book of Enoch.
Ah, yes, right. Yeah, the Bible even refers to the Book of Enoch, the Book of Jasher. Jim and I are talking about some of these other books that are referred to in the Bible. Yeah. Interesting. These five. Notice that these four are spiritual beings, but this one's pure flesh. This is human. You catch the picture? This one's with you all the time. This is a constant warfare going on. Here's what the Zohar says to sum up. I think it's pretty interesting. Quote, all of these five, tend to bring the world back to the state of tohu and bohu, in other words, of emptiness and void. And they caused the destruction of the temple. Now in the Zohar, it was already being discussed, it's referring to the destruction of the first temple. The second hadn't been built yet. But I think it applies to the second temple as well. Because I think we definitely see the spirit of the Giborim, religion and pride and legalism, as contributing to the destruction of the temple. Because this had polluted the Jewish nation. I think we see the spirit of lust. We see all these things going on. Of course, the sages say that when the Messiah comes, he'll either come during a time of great holiness and dedication, or a time of great depravity and sin. Well, the first time, he came at a time of great sin. When he returns, I think he'll come back to a holy nation. So I think they're right on both counts. But moving on. It says, but as tohu and bohu gave place to light. Remember, God looked at the earth as tohu and bohu, but then he said, let there be light. Gave place to light. So when God reveals himself, they will be wiped off the earth. So I'll just take them right off the overhead. They're gone. They'll be wiped off the earth. But nevertheless, redemption will not be complete until Amalek will be exterminated. For against Amalek, the oath was taken that the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. Isn't that interesting? Fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, anything like this that helps me understand the spiritual warfare, I can't see the spirit realm. And so I must depend upon the word of God and the word of wise men who can speak to me and speak of that which is spiritual. We'd do well to heed those things. I really wanted to talk about Caleb and wiping out the Anakim. But we'll just end with this. We don't have time. Caleb was such a man of Emunah. Such a man of Emunah. And read closely the story of how he gives his daughter to Othniel, who was his brother. So Caleb became his brother's father-in-law and his daughter's father-in-law. It's kind of interesting. And Othniel, you'll read in the book of Judges, replaced Joshua. Othniel became the first judge of Israel. Yahashua's replacement was Othniel, Caleb's brother and son-in-law. Pardon me?
Is it a picture of righteousness?
Oh, definitely righteousness. Othniel means lion of God. Yes. And everything about Othniel, wonderful man. Wonderful man. But Othniel and Caleb are a picture of Emet and Emunah. You look at the two, his brother. And it's almost like God says, okay, I'm going to take Caleb, I'm going to open him up so you can see his nephesh, his neshama. You see truth and you can see Emunah in his life. Look at it in that way, and you'll see some wonderful things. Those few lines there. And I want to show something to you here real quickly. Remember how I showed that Emunah starts with the first letter of the alphabet, includes the middle letter, and then the very next one? In Hebrew thought, the letters are not on a line, they're in a circle. You have Aleph, and you can move around the circle to Mem, okay, the second letter of Amunah, and of course there's the third letter of Amunah, which is Nun, and it goes on around to the letter Tav, and then you're back to the beginning. Everything in Hebrew thought is in a circle. In fact, the Kabbalah talks about how the letters form a crown upon God's head. They make a complete circle. Okay? So here's the word for Emunah. Aleph, Mem, and Nun. Now let's take the name of Caleb. Caleb's, the first two letters of Caleb's name, it's spelled like this. Kof, Lamed, Beit. These two letters here are the two letters that directly precede Mem. So you put the Kof here. I'm sorry, I'm making it backwards. Kof, Lamed. But to get to Beit, you have to go all the way around the circle, all the way past Tav, past Aleph, and then the very next letter. He's a man of Amunah, and he's a man of truth, because he completes that whole dark period of darkness and pain, comes all the way around to the beginning again. Do you see that? Can you see that? Caleb starts here. The first two letters right before, so you have Kof, Lamed, Mem, Nun. Those come right in a row in the alphabet. So they're the first two letters of Caleb's name. But it goes all the way through that dark period. It goes all the way from here, Kof, Lamed, goes all the way around, and it comes back to Beit. You see that? It makes the complete circle. It makes the complete journey. And that's what we see in Caleb's life. Caleb is a picture of truth and Amunah. Because it's truth, he went into the Eretz Israel because he'd been there before. He knew it. He had seen it all. He'd seen the Anakim. There were no mysteries. That's what truth is. You had knowledge. He went in with knowledge. He's also a man of Amunah. But in the story of Caleb and Othniel, you see Caleb being the epitome of truth and Othniel the epitome of Amunah. And you look at those two together and you see how Caleb had both of those. Truth and Amunah together. Let's close with this thought. How do you get more knowledge? How do you get more Amunah? By hearing. Amunah comes from hearing the Word of God, right? You have to have the fact, the knowledge. But your strength, your Amunah strengthens, your knowledge strengthens with victories after victory after victory. The growth in Amunah is accumulative. And every time you make the circle and you succeed in some area and your Amunah proves true, you've got more. Every time you make the circle and you've gone from Aleph to Tav and seen truth, God gives you more. And as you continue to grow from, what does it say? Growing from Amunah to Amunah, from faith to faith. Remember that phrase Paul uses? You understand what it means now? We go from level to level to level. And we can come to the point, there's a goal for us. We can come to the point where our Amunah is perfect. It's perfect. And we can face the most tragic, the most disappointing. We can go into martyrdom with joy because we know the outcome. And we've seen this in history with the sages and with the Christian martyrs. They had such Amunah in God that they could face the worst tortures. And they went through it with joy because they knew what was on the other side. What does it say of Yeshua? It says, because of the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. He had Amunah in the goal. He couldn't see it right then, but he knew it was there. He knew the promises of God. And he could go through the darkness and pain because he knew what was ahead, even though he could not see it at the time. This is a pattern for us. This is a pattern for us. And by God's grace, we'll grow up under that. Let's pray. Father, thank you again for your truth. Thank you for the life of Caleb. Help us to be like him, Lord. Help us to be like Yeshua, like Abraham, like all those who are lifted up in your word, being examples of Amunah, examples of truth. Lord, we're surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses, such godly, wonderful examples of what we can be. Lord, let us not fall short. Let us not be easily satisfied with ourselves. That, Father, may we keep moving from what's familiar to what you draw us to the land you're calling us to. May we grow from level of faith to faith, from amuna to amuna. Become tomorrow more than I was yesterday. Help us to be faithful to work on our souls and to make them more into the people you want us to be. And this we'll do, Lord, with your help. And we ask for that help in Yeshua's name. Amen.